United. Way across the campuses is only growing in its importance as we are moving forward. And one way or the other, what I find amazing, encouraging, and special, call it whatever you want, is that we are talking here about an activity that spans 70 institutions,
80.
80s. I'm not aware of any other activity that spans that many institutions. Some people may tell me networking. I have an argument with that because we are operating at a very different level in terms of the involvement about. And the question for all of us is how can we do more and better to support, to advance, to enhance what's happening on the campuses as the lay of the land is changing around us. And I think we have to realize that it is. Now, I feel that we are best equipped to deal with change because of our philosophy of being distributed, local autonomy, all the nice things. But nevertheless, it's going to be a challenge on how we are doing this, and it is on the brain. The other part that I want to stress is while I think we are doing okay on the research side, I think the numbers are for the last year, we had over 600 users in the OS pool representing more than 220 projects on the OS pool, running an amazing amount of jobs. Over 200 million jobs were executed on the OS pool in the last year. I don't know, 10 times as many files were moved around. So, see, I find this to be amazing. But where I don't think we are where we need to be is on the education mission of the campuses. We are getting some more traction, but I find it unfortunate that the OS pool, and you can add now the OS store slash OSDF, we are not yet contributing what I would like to see us contributing to the teaching. And for me, I see the impediment is we don't find the instructors on the ground that are motivated or see value or have ideas on how to use what we can offer for their classroom. I was really sort of some level amazed that when Christina gave the tutorial at the CC Star event and how people were shocked that she was able to run 50 notebooks out of the box as part of the tutorial. It worked. I mean, we almost took down the
Yeah,
network.
say no thanks to Wi-Fi.
And those of you here who are coming from the campus, you are the troops on the ground. We cannot do these things sitting here. And several reasons. One is because we are remote. And B, I'm very much aware that here the mentality of an R1. We are not in a position to understand what is happening in the different campuses. So that's on my mind.
Thank you.
But it's a free-for-all. Anything that comes up from anyone, let's just use this as a forum to think better.
Lauren brought up a couple of points. Not the classic, how do we do more or better? How do we find people teaching for whom this would be a good fit? If anyone has thoughts on those questions or have your own questions about our services.
Amy has her hand.
Oh, Amy.
Okay, yeah, now I can, now you can hear.
Yeah.
So Maroon, I really appreciate your comments. I don't know exactly who's in the room. Can you all hear me?
Yes.
Okay, cool. It would be interesting to me to know if or how you're using the resources OS Pool in teaching now on your campus. Like around the room or something.
This is Kurt from University of Hawaii. I'll pop in my talk on Friday. I'll mention this, but we released a data set with along with a publication, and we're very interested in seeing that data get used. And an obvious opportunity is to incorporate it into some kind of course, whether it's students or anybody that's interested in learning about solar, studying the sun. And so I'm just thinking about opportunities to collaborate at collaborating with the National Data Platform, which is linked to NAIR as a resource, and they are working on building out capability to deliver courses and to connect the course content with data sets that is available. So I'll comment that as I've talked to my solar faculty, and it's difficult to get them to fully engage with this. So I think there's a real outreach challenge start to figure out how to
So how
engage with them.
do we do the outreach effect? I mean, it's I'm personally somewhat concerned about the NAIR approach, which is more we will build it and it will come, which always gets me nervous.
My gather is it's a big grab bag of things, and it's a little hard to navigate.
I know it's more than a little, but we have recently a couple of examples. I think the longest ongoing example it's Tim is the group in Japan, right? That
About 10 years at this point, yeah.
For example, but this is. This group in Japan, the students were part of their assignment was to sign up to be Swedish. So that is you should listen to it. So you can even argue that making a HPC, no, since we are doing virtual, we have they just got the last numbers, the 330 remote registration. Is that a place to start? But who will sign up? I don't know. I have also is the issue hosting the course material? Is it what I envision the challenge of and that's what I talked to some smaller campuses is. I need 30 notebooks at 10 in the morning for an hour. How do I get to this? And we have been doing some of it, not in the context of the OS pool, we've worked with two tribal colleges. So we are running at Discovery outside of this one operation for a GIS classes. And by the way, one of the challenges we have there is that this is an old window button. And when we move in this space, Windows is not exactly our expertise. But we are fortunate that in Discover IT, we have a window group and we are running a window server to host the server. So, and I can tell you in that case, the server that we are now working with another college to use it, the cost of that was less than what they were charged for one semester of hosting in the cloud. But at least I believe that OSDF helped in staging and scheduling. The capacity needed to run a class of 30 kids at 10 a.m. on Monday. And since we have the redundancy in our power, we can provide it at fairly high availability because if these resources are not available, we have ways to bring in more capacity. And I view the dependency on us to be critical to the success. If you come to a class and you count on having 30 notebooks, and then 10 minutes before that, you have to get to know that story. And we have to reschedule you because of blah, blah, blah. And we cannot give you the 30 notebooks. That's not good. And I feel confident that we can do high availability this month. But we need somebody comes in and says, yes, that's what we want to do.
Back to Amy's question, other comments on supporting the education mission?
Just to POV from my student, so I'm undergraduate. I just have a question for a sales person. Maybe do we ever explicitly label Encore as like something meant for educational use? Because if you look up like Google Cloud, there's the main Google Cloud page for developers, whatever, who wants to use it, whatever. But there's also a side page that explicitly identifies Google Cloud for Education or Google Cloud educational credits, et cetera. And so if instructors are looking for, I need to teach X, Y, Z, and I don't have a computer to run all these things for my kids, et cetera, Google Cloud will definitely show up, but I don't know if HTConf
Right. It's like a label. It's like
Yeah.
HTConf for education
Just like a
or
side page. The
yeah.
Google Cloud page is a cloud for education. Honestly, repeats a lot of the stuff on the main page, but it characterizes what the use for instructors is and what using Google Cloud for Educator look like. We get your free credits from this page. Your kids will each get a credit, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. Yeah, we have a page that's like, you know, use notebooks for your event. I think Rachel wrote up, and it has a lot of that good information, but it's very buried, and it's not like easily clickable from the front page the way like you're describing. That's really important.
I looked up like Connor for Education, and you don't really get any hits.
I think
some of the topics are about like the actual work. You know,
very good point.
So I think that would be
great. Yeah.
So maybe it's a little contentious. So what's the experience? I guess I'm wondering, what is the experience for folks who are using it for teaching in terms of like actual nuts and bolts, like stability and success with running workloads and things like that? Like I remember 10 years ago or so, you know, like get a little nervous when you have a bunch of students submitting stuff, but then it's like, oh, you know, this darn node in Chicago is crashing all the jobs or whatever.
Yeah.
So what is the experience like today? So I'm sort of removed from it now.
I think we've really been pushing people to use the Jupyter service that we operate, the notebooks. There's two options. You can have a full account. Your notebook connects to a full-blown AP and submits jobs to the list pool. But then you don't need to talk to us at all, and you can there's like a guest profile, basically. And that's just a self-contained Condor test pool. So that environment is quite consistent. And so obviously you have to troubleshoot things, all the usual. But I think that is pretty seamless. So the greater concern is the reliability of the actual Jupyter service itself. But in terms of pool performance, it's more stable. And something we've talked about before is having like a walled garden part of the OS pool where, you know, we mark nodes as like reliable or different things so that we could, for certain groups or classes, kind of put them into the shallow pool before you dump them into the deep end kind of a situation, which I think we would want to think about if we ended up having a lot of educational use cases, because we might outgrow the sort of ability to support little custom test parties.
I think that for me, the question would be what is the educational purpose mission that you expect us, the OS pool, the condo, whatever the label is, to support the field. So I can say, and we had one case, Rich Wolski in Santa Barbara did it for several years, for his uniform, was really to teach students to swim in the big pool. And to say, this is not lava land, this is there. And a lot of things, and the uncertainty and the out of order and all the kind of things, that's an opportunity. So you really want to show to them that going out there to an environment like this is scared. Because I think it's a wrong message to send to a student that running with the OS pool is like running on your laptop. I don't personally believe in this seamless, so nothing is seen. But that's one thing. But if you come and say, look, I'm running a course and I want to run 100 simulations to plot the curve of something against something, then I need it as a dependable source of capacity. So because where I'm getting nervous, if you have 100 kids in the class and the assignment is due on Monday, which I will strongly encourage you not to do it, and then they all start using it Monday, it's Sunday at 10 p.m. after they had a long weekend of God knows what, Then we have to be ready there because they all need to get the data out and everything. So is it a source of capacity for a class where you want them to understand what it means to collect their data? Or is it really running? I talked to one class, a one faculty who said, my problem is I'm teaching a bio something like that, a biology an informatics course. And I'm really limited by the amount of data that I can give them for the class experience. I think you said something ridiculous like five, I don't know. I don't want a small amount of my output data, which I asked them why. He said, look, they have these old laptops that they have to download it to their tablet. There's no room, so if we can give them 10 or 20 notebooks with whatever, a half a terabyte of each to do the thing, they will have a different experience during class. So you see, these are different cases. And for each of them, we need a live instructor because there will be some pain. One thing that we learned actually with our tribal thing is, okay, how do I edit and experiment with the notebook before I get it ready for the student? Becomes non-trivial. Because if we do it in our environment and they have to do it remotely, and we are going into some of the discussion that I had in the plenary, okay, this image runs on this container here on my laptop, and will it run over there? So that's where we need to work with somebody who is willing and committed to get it done. And not just to, okay, can you make it ready for me by next month?
I think that is the challenge, though, Marone, because just based on my conversations with people who are teaching, especially when they have a high teaching load, is that their bandwidth for doing extra things is non-existent. They're going to keep doing the thing that they've been doing because that's what they have time to do. So it's a real, I think it's a real job.
So I don't know, that goes into if a campus has the luxury to tell an instructor, that's what we do. I know in our system that sometimes you are getting a reduction in teaching load to develop a new course. That's right.
And I have a question, especially for anyone representing a PUI. I think Christina's experience might be more from kind of the R1 experience, where faculty are part of the reason they're overloaded is because they have the teaching load, they have the research load, they have their students, et cetera. I'm wondering if the experience is any different at smaller institutions that are more focused on teaching.
It
I don't know. It's worse.
Yeah, no, that was actually from conversations I had when I was at Merced. And
Oh,
just like they're teaching more
I
classes
see.
and trying to do a little bit of research on top. And so what I took away from that was like the time to like target instructors is in the summer because that's when they have even like a modicum of spare cycles to consider these things. Like during the semester, it's like, well, and then it's too late, obviously, if you're
Right.
planning for a class, but that's my takeaway. Yeah.
I'm Fong from GW, George Washington University. What kind of, so I'm fairly new to this. We're hoping to integrate this afternoon. That always cool. But what kind of, I guess, teaching material do you guys offered, like I guess specifically for HD Fund, or just to say some stuff on our side, I guess we are at a, technically an R1 institution, but we, my team does a lot of work in terms of teaching students how to use their classroom. So we have like a form on how to sign up, copy your SSA key and all that. About once a quarter or a semester, we offer class, I guess, through HPC carpentries that we kind of modify and I guess it's like our own version on how to access our cluster. We also have Scadam on here. He's taught some, it was like a school of public health, like for a few classes that he taught bioinformatics research students how to get on to the cluster and how to run jobs. We're a learning institution right now. So it's like how to do parallel writing jobs. So I guess what do you have in terms of, you know, something along carpentries or helping to educate the educators?
No, it's a good question. We have we do training as a team, and a lot of those materials are recorded and available online. So that there's material. I will say it's not like user ready in the way that like the carpentry's materials are like meant to be taught by other people, and that's a gap in what we offer. So certainly someone who is enterprising could copy those materials. A lot of them are like Google Slides or PowerPoints that you could copy yourself and tweak. We have tutorials in GitHub repositories that are like, you know, have everything and you can clone them and use them on any Condor system. You can use the notebooks. So I think we have a lot of raw materials, but we don't like have a finished, like off the shelf, everything assembled kind of training materials. And that would apply for both people who want to teach in the context of like researchers, like helping them use the system, or people who are working in an we have, I think, even less in the educational context of like, you know, pull it off the shelf and incorporate it into your semester class where people actually have to like get a grade and you might want to think about assignments and quizzes and things like that. So, we have had instructors do that. But
in your training on campus, who is your target audience? Are these students in the classroom or is that graduate students and who need computing for the research?
So we're targeting students and researchers, but the oftentimes we'll have professors that we work with pretty closely because, like, from the CS department or School of Public Health, they have specific applications that they use that leverage our cluster. So
they use it in the classroom or they use it in the lab to. Because I think these are two fundamentally different audiences. I think we have much more experience, and the Stinas team is working with over 300 projects on this campus. And yesterday you heard the interaction with the Cal facilitation. We look at this more as a facilitation task than an education. I think we should keep talking about it, but I think it's important that we understand the different audiences that we, and I feel we are in a better, far from perfect, position in helping researcher, computer science faculty, and what have you, to get to the point where they benefit from your school or the CHDC capacity on our campus. But when it comes to the classroom experience, that's where we are not doing much. That I have a class and I need it for my class.
That's what you're lacking in?
That's why I think we have almost no traction. Okay. Is that the first statement?
I mean, I think we've had success with people who know us in the sense of like talking heroes course, Nate's course this spring. But yeah, like finding a broader audience is tricky. Yeah, Hulu.
So have instructors, professors in the classroom, come to you and said, we have a problem, that we need more access to the OS pool. I raise this question because at FIU, we have a campus HPC, and I've been messaging here with our HPC administrator about, like, we have two researchers that are using, making extensive use of the OS pool right now, but it's just for research.
Right.
They're not using it for the classroom.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I'm trying to find out, well, why is that? Why don't they also expose the students to it? But apparently they don't use it in the same way in the classroom. So I'm just wondering, your top users or your researchers are using the OS pool, if they're also teaching, you know, is there really a demand for the OS pool in the classroom? Maybe they're making the sufficient use of local resources for teaching purposes.
Yeah, I think that's a fair question.
Or do they teach those topics at all, especially to undergraduates? I mean, I at the point where my own daughters are going through the school system, and I get the sense that especially at the undergraduate level, many of them are not taught the techniques that even the beginning graduate students are half expected to know how to use. And they all pick it up on the fly from the grad student who's a year older than them and so on. It's very informal and unstructured, it seems like, for these kind of crucial, well, laboratory techniques, whatever, but you know, the computing based ones.
So it's true there could be like a teaching gap.
Yeah, we have a question slash comment from Amy online. She asked, is there documentation of the minimal hardware requirements for a laptop to run a Jupyter notebook? She wonders if the OS pool for teaching would be advertised as turn any classroom into a computer lab using even old student laptops, load with your own software and access thousands of processors and GPUs. Also, are there expectations for the network that might be a challenge for small institutions?
Really, really, that's a good question.
She also knows that people who need to know about this are the computer lab administrators on campus.
Oh, that's an excellent thought. I don't think that's an audience I would have thought you were going to reach out to. You can write copy for us anytime. That's great. Yeah. I don't know if there's anyone here who can speak to kind of the network required.
Just a quick comment. So you mentioned Wi-Fi earlier.
Yeah.
The Wi-Fi in the room is something that is going to be a local concern. Right? So
yeah.
At Loeb University, you know, it's a community college and they're under-resourced. That's a common problem.
Right. So and, people are going
on the
away.
The other advantage of this Jupyter notebook pattern, right, is the bandwidth that I need is pretty minimal.
Yeah.
Right? Because it's just a web browser.
Right. Yeah, you're not downloading the data.
And you're leveraging the high bandwidth, the cache and whatever storage. And stuff, you know? So it's a virtuous model, actually.
Yeah.
Teaching, but you do have to have some commitment from the.
Yeah, and again, I think you're touching on this, but even if a campus has good connectivity out to the WAN in general, that doesn't mean that classroom 201 in this building has, you know, can support 50 students hitting the Wi-Fi all at the same time with notebooks. Those are two different things.
Yeah,
I just taught a workshop a few weeks ago where the students weren't able to connect to the SSH board because the guest network prevented it. So you're running into issues like that as well.
So since you are representing the students, if you're spot here, from your experience so far in the human design, have you seen any of the courses that exposure, inclusion, leverage of the CHTC would have made your experience as a student better, greater, I don't know, whatever. Can you come and say, walk up to the instructor and say, why didn't you use CHTC? Now that I know about it, that I know what it can do, why were you so lazy not to include it into our report? So I think that's the challenge. Challenge is going back to my value proposition question. I mean, can you as a student see the value that could have? Yes, we can advertise it and make it this, and people may find it and look at it. You know, what motivates Google to have Google education is a question by itself. But given that we are in the university setting, it's because we believe in the education mission, and we want to do better. So the question is, can we even come to one of the instructors here in Virginia Science and say, hey, here's an opportunity for you to do better. We just talked to one of your students, and they told me that it's unfortunate that he didn't have an opportunity to experience Fondo or CHTC in the world, because it would have helped them to do better whatever you were doing.
Is there any courseware available that provides script, you know, course information that basically a professor can just pick off the shelf, you know, like a textbook, and use it?
Yeah. That, I don't think we have anything quite at that sort of finished stage. We have, like I said, some pieces, but not a
tool. To use it to do what?
Yeah. Well, to teach, like, for example, provide an assignment that uses the OS pool. Here is a classic example, let's say in biology, where there's a good benefit from using the OS pool as opposed to trying to use just whatever you have locally on your campus.
So Julio, we have with the OSG school, we leave all the materials up, and I would argue that it has good but domain A specific examples. I think part of what you're hitting on in your question is to make something that a faculty member in some domain is going to pull off the shelf and just use, it probably has to have at least some domain specificity to it.
Yeah.
And so then there's the question of which domain should we get? What examples?
How general I think then it's yes, but we are not experts in any domain.
Right.
We're just plumbers. So if we want to make an example in biology or in engineering or whatever, we need somebody from biology or engineering to help us out, and we don't have it.
Well, I mean, you have people here. Your keynote speaker is a biologist, right?
Yeah.
Has any developed something that can work? Because we have something that could be adapted.
We typically don't, and the question is, we could say, yes, it's very interesting, but I'm working on, you know, our keynote is because unfortunately missed the celebration yesterday because he worked. He had all the other things. So that's where we are getting into time barriers or priority setting or what.
Yeah, no, I mean,
but we can. if we have several examples, then we can use them. If we had half a dozen examples, we would have said, okay, here's what we did in this course in biology, we used it to do da 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 da. So this gives you an example of one case. Now, this means biology itself is a huge space, but we can at least say, here's some examples.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if you make it easier for the professor.
Of course.
You would get more adoption.
Yeah.
Wait, are you asking this partially just so that if a faculty member sees an example, right, they can see what would be possible for their own case, which may be, of course, different and have a different domain specificity. But to me, this sounds a lot like, you know, one of our basic principles of facilitation is that users are going to listen to each other and each other's examples better than they listen to us telling them that something is possible. And seeing how someone else has done it makes a big difference for them imagining themselves implementing something. Of course, they have to implement their own specific examples for, you know, but the notebook part and the scaling part and the getting the students set up part is the part they don't want to have to reinvent the wheel on, and that should be generalized as an invention, right? And so, like, sort of showing them and being really clear, these were the parts that were generalizable, this is the part the faculty member did, and from the perspective of this is what the faculty member did, not this is what OST did or what Pondo did, things
right.
like that.
You know, I'm just thinking about examples that I've seen with, let's say, for example, Fabric. They have these Jupyter notebooks where they have developed all sorts of examples as to do certain things. I'm seeing many examples of networking and also.
Yeah, but they're expert in network.
No, but it's they just take in, they have the information there available in a notebook that people can then use it and adapt it to what their specific.
How many biologists can you
think about? I don't know. But I'm sure they have some.
But one thing is following on them that may be a way to go. And we don't, and it's an ongoing complaint that I have about wrestling. So let's assume I want to set up a class with 30 notebooks for Monday morning in their fall semester. We don't provide, here is what you need to do. Okay, we say, talk to us, and that's it. We they say, okay, what? So we don't have gone internally through what would be needed to okay, you send the request to us, which has to have two pages to justify, you give us the shoe size of whatever. And at some level, it's no different than you're placing a job in the OS pool, you have to tell me how much memory you need and for how long do you need it, and da-da-da-da-da-da-da. We never, how many seats do you need, at what frequency, and let's ignore it now. How are you going to upload your image?
Mm-hmm.
How are you going to edit? How are you going to test it before class? How are you going to, I don't think we ever, on our end, went through all these steps end to end where the notebook itself is hello world.
Mm-hmm.
Welcome to the notebook provided to you by the OS pool. Here's who you should send your thanks for providing you with this experience, and then go and do your whatever it is. And I think that's maybe the direction that we have to explore, is because I don't think we ever thought through the whole process. And here's the hotline in case if you're experiencing problems. And then to warn them, look, we can do it that much, but We are not there. We cannot guarantee this. And don't schedule it on a Monday. You're better off scheduling it on a Wednesday. In the same way that we tell people, don't upgrade your system on a Friday and go on vacation. Upgrade your system on a Monday and watch it for the week, right? Have you experienced the Friday upgrade?
So Marone, we have this. I mean, it's not visible. All the usual caveat.
Can you see it?
We're working on the lights. But I think what you're describing is something a little more procedural and detailed, whereas this is a little more conceptual, kind of like, you know, look at what we have, test your materials.
I don't think that our fault that we in CFTC really went through this process. We are coming in, it's a little bit, more than a little bit, like the condom documentation. Here are all the options.
Okay.
Here are, what is it, condo summit, 60 knobs. It doesn't say that's what you want to do. Here are the knobs that you should be aware of. It says, okay, here's everything we can do. Now it's your problem to figure out what you need out of it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we've definitely actually done that, but it's not written down. Rachel?
Just to kind of continue off of things that are being said over in this kind of room, I think almost like a page before staff come and faculty come to this page, it's like one page that says what you guys can 100% support. Like at this moment, you can request 30 notebooks without like a customized setup.
Right.
We support this software, not licensing or stuff like that. Like, are GPUs an option? Like, what is a faculty, if I want to even look at this resource, what can I assume is the basic starting thing without any customization or anything like that?
What's the base package?
Yeah, what's the base package
that
I could get today?
Right.
And then, you know, a little note at the bottom that says, like, more is available and things like that.
Yeah. And talk to us or open this little menu.
Yeah, but it's like a single page that could even be like sent out to faculty. This is like, this is what it is. Basis, you can get 30 notebooks today, right now. This software is like, I think something like that that's very as black and white as possible. You know, it's not fully, you know.
Yeah. Like more specific and not just like, here's the beautiful picture of all the things.
Even then, it feels like you'd need some kind of reservation system, because an off chance that 100 different faculty across the country all write into that page at the same time, maybe we don't have 100% guarantee anymore.
But I think it's like another...
I would not worry about it.
Yeah.
I never worried about it. I was, for the last 40 years, I would always say, what are you going to do when you're running on out of capacity?
And I think
I want to be there.
Okay. Yeah.
We'll solve it. I'm willing to overcommit and to apologize at this stage than to worry about what will happen if I have a million faculty approaching.
Yeah.
I don't lose sleep.
Did you have anything to add then?
Yeah, I think just kind of getting off what Marone is saying is those caveats, we all know they exist. And yes, it's possible to like spam DDoS the websites for that, but in an ideal, like, good day, what can you guys provide?
Right. Yeah. That's super helpful. Yeah.
Well, maybe add a different perspective on this, which is one of the themes here has been books. And it strikes me that teaching community, a different community, relative to the research. So
right.
You might want to think about. And think deeply about what it means to build a lead and interact with them. And one suggestion might be to engage with within your existing community who may be, you know, like myself, maybe a liaison to astronomer faculty who come to me and say, I need 20 laptops for the summer class that I'm teaching to our new students. And And I can't say, oh, well, what you should do, so, but then I'll know it's blue.
Right.
So I am very interested in that. There's a NCAR high altitude observatory, runs a summer 2-week spectral polar imagery school every summer. You bring your laptop. I attended as a student with your laptop. You run a bunch of Dr. Jupyter notebooks all week long on the laptop, and every student has a slightly different experience based on what they are able to actually get working on the laptop. And it's a real opportunity to, I could reach out to those student people and say, hey.
Especially since the NCAR data is
there's some synergy. There are some synergies here. This particular data isn't, and that's one of
that's
goals, great. But anyway, my point that really is maybe
but this what I hear
people
you
in your current community to start working on a new community.
Yeah. But what I hear you Kurt saying is kind of echoing what Amy said about like sometimes talk to the people that run the computer labs or provide the technology to maybe we don't talk to instructors directly, but we talk to people who support the instructors and then like it's and then they can help facilitate.
Who may already be in
so right, exactly.
So
exactly.
If you want to create kind of a working group or a,
yeah.
a birds of a feather related
yeah.
to this, I'd be happy to jump in.
I think that's an important point to like teaching is its own community. For us, it's a newer community, but it has its own value. You know, the value proposition for that community would be different. And they, you know, yeah, they also probably have their own events and their own channels of communication and
well, and it's a
something to be aware of.
Venn diagram, right? Your R1s, your current community faces kind of a research community, but you know, it's a different bubble that overlaps some. But we have private universities and community colleges and undergraduate teaching institutions. There's a lot of those.
Yeah,
well, that's sort of my idea. You know, there was a time when I saw the OSGD and Condor doing more outreach through communities of facilitators and other folks who work with faculty. And that's how a lot of them were pointing their faculty and other researchers to the OS pool, to State Condor sometimes. That's how they were learning about and then going about implementing Condor on their local systems. And so I think there's room to be doing that type of outreach. So you're not just speaking to the folks who are already in the bubble, right? But sort of continually promoting the types of things that OSG and Condor can support, you know, the introduction to high throughput computing and what types of research and education use cases work really well in the space, that kind of stuff. That's one kind of training that I think you have to do kind of on repeat and not just at PERT, but where people are hearing about you
right.
even ahead of doing a tutorial like that. At
oh, yeah. There's you can't just kind of show up once a year.
Yeah. You know,
expect people to remember who you are.
There are communities of those professionals that are like national, you know, champions, PARC, et cetera. But there's also like the consortium of liberal arts colleges. There's
right.
research computing at smaller institutions that I know you were at last year because we were both there, but it happens to be this week.
This week.
You know, there's stuff like that where campuses and the folks who are working a lot with faculty
right.
and educators and researchers are there and especially catching them when it's something like RCSI or FLAC. It's even like a narrower community
yeah.
where you can get a little richer engagement and understanding of how their
yeah.
needs might be different from say the
right.
ones, et cetera.
Yeah, and hear more about kind of their particular
yeah.
problems.
I feel like I should put on my flying suit before I say this, but if there's a perception by students and faculty that the documentation is too daunting or unclear to them for whatever reason, they're more likely these days to ask ChatGPT and
yeah.
things about stuff like this. And so you might consider just asking it yourself, like approaching it from the user and seeing what it says to see if it's correct.
Mm-hmm.
And for instance, if I say, what is OSTF an OS pool? It says they're components of the open science grid.
The problem is we can't.
Yeah, what do you do?
What do you do?
Right, but I mean, you know, you can at least understand where they'll be coming from.
That's true. Like what their misconceptions might be at the start.
You might
yeah.
even, like, for instance, I mean, might also consider its approach to providing steps as a way of, well, clearly providing steps or something.
Right, right, right. Yeah.
It says you have a good support group.
Well, at least that's something, maybe.
Not to, like, you know,
say the same thing again and again, but just to emphasize how I think we might currently lack the infrastructure to make this easy for education. The way that CS undergrad courses look at UW-Madison, that it's like multiple sections of 300 students for every single class.
Right.
So this is one instructor that has like 900 kids. And so obviously, if you're trying to submit their assignment on Monday night at 11:50, they don't go to the instructor. You're not supposed to. You're supposed to go to the team of like 35 to 40 TAs who all have a kind of varied understanding of how to actually fix your bug. And so this isn't information that we would need to just effectively disseminate to the instructor. The instructor has to also be able to make it so that all 35, 40 of these TAs can handle whatever issues kids are having. And I think it just has to be very easy for everyone involved for it to be viable.
Right. Yeah, and that idea of
scaling up.
Yeah, and accessible material, or like, yeah, it's not just thinking about the instructor, but the people supporting the instructor. Yeah. It has to work all the way across the board.
But my hope is that if some of this is embedded in the notebook, then it becomes easy. So it creates a more limited and controlled environment rather than sending them to the wild at CHDT. And it's really not designed to be a safe place. It's sort of for them. So, and I don't know how ready are the instructors of the PAs to create these notebook environments that they have now. It would have been interesting to look at, from your experience, some of the assignments, and do some reverse engineering and say, look, if I had to do this assignment with an notebook assignment, how would it work?
I think that at the very, very early classes of computer science, at least in UW-Madison, the instructors probably don't want to deal with any of that because the kids are kind of overwhelmed just connecting to a PM and learning how to just run their code. Like, they're in the very early steps of how do I write code, run it, or, you know, how do I think functionally, how do I iterate through an array, et cetera. And so they want to create the easiest, most frictionless environment to convey those concepts before they start to understand the environment in which their code runs, et cetera. I would see Condor more likely to be used in a higher level class. I know we don't like if domains used in class
either. I would say that at least in my thinking here is that Condor is not visible to the student at any of what I'm talking about. Condor is in the background provisioning. Let me give you an example. We are, in any kind of the master worker setting, the coordinator is sending out work to the worker, and Condor is not involved in that. Condor is involved in deploying the work. So the coordinator has no visibility of any of these. We are saying, all it knows is that if I put the piece of work here, somebody will pick it up, distribute it up. So I think more about, even in the introduction, can you give the student a notebook in which they are playing around? There's no color, there's no condo, but the fact that there are 300 kids that need a 300 notebook, where are they coming from? And I assume today they say use your laptop.
So there's a difference between providing like infrastructure for teaching, just kind of using Condor as part of that, and then teaching about Condor or teaching about. And I think that gets a little bit at the use cases that we've been describing, that some people aren't really going to want to teach about Condor. It's really like, I want to do a data analysis or I want to run simulations. That's the focus of the course. And we really want to hide away as much of the concrete pieces as possible. Then there may be other courses, probably like the one that Papiro is teaching, where part of the goal is actually like, how do you submit jobs? How do you think about high throughput computing? And that would be a different teaching use case. And so what you're describing here, Marone, is a little bit more of like the first one of like an environment for lots of people to work in their domain. Is that correct?
It's really a master work model where Kondo is the provisioner and not the subject matter. You can always think about when you get into simulation, you learn about how you run your simulation in the notebook over and over, and then you want to scale out. And I can come up here with ideas of how you go from the notebook into the Kondo world, but I think that for most cases in education, the word Kondo should not be mentioned.
So my worry with this scenario that you brought up, where it's like an introductory class and they never have to deal with the mess on, is that these introductory classes will have relatively limited use for like really high throughput because it's a very small.
No, I'm not talking about high throughput. They need, I think I made it clear, the only thing which is our job is to provide the class with 300 notebooks at 10 o'clock on Monday.
So we're like collab.
No,
right,
but
basically,
well, that's what I was going to say, is that there's so many other alternatives that are capable of providing something similar with...
Well, what are the alternatives?
Well, there's Kaggle, there's Collab, there's Google...
Where is
it? They don't integrate with
pays
science.
For Google Cloud? Who pays for Google Cloud?
Yeah, I think, like...
Don't do on me debate. She's a professional debater, so be careful with her.
A lot of those are free, Mara.
What is that?
A lot of them are free.
So fine. If they are free, they are fine. Anyone who believes in free has a problem. Today they are free, tomorrow they are not free. Okay?
But now they're
so now they are free, fine. So then we don't provide any value. There's no reason for us to compete with Google. If Google is doing it and everyone is happy, then we should, that's not what I hear by talking for researchers. So I was at the CC Star meeting and the work campus was the best. I am teaching this informatics course and I cannot do it. I'm teaching scalability. Yes, in this case, it was parallel computing, but I want to do scalability. I cannot do it.
Right. Well, and someone I think over here was going to mention there's limits on what is free. And so then the value becomes more.
And look, all these stupid people that believe that Google gives you free storage, go for it, all the kind of things. Suddenly they said, now you have to pay, and everyone is running to figure out what to do with all the crap they put in. I mean, Google is doing everything they do to make money. That everyone, they should teach you that in computing 101. The only reason why they exist is to make money. And anytime you think that they are doing anything for free, it's a set statement on where we are. Because if you think that Google Maps is free, no, it's not free. They want to know where you are, at what speed you are going. They are just collecting the hell out of you. And that's the reason why they are doing it. They don't care whether you find your way to a restaurant.
All of that may be true, but I think the point still stands that like being aware of what is available and what others are providing allows you to address gaps or particular needs that are not met by regardless of how it's paid for, what data they're collecting. Faculty may be aware of that. But they have a menu of places to go to for different things, and I think it's a good point.
So for me, the question is, always comes up, how much effort do we put into it compared to others? So, yes, we have to be aware of where we have value.
Yeah.
And if we don't have value, we should not go there. So if the answer for the community, yes, it's a great idea, but I get it from Google, so who cares? I am not interested in this context to teach Kondo. I'm interested in enabling researchers to do better in the classroom in their vision that has nothing to do with Kondo.
So yeah, I think Lauren's point is a good one in the sense that like knowing what other people offer then allows us to articulate what our value proposition is because we know what else is in this space and what we
want to formulate whether we have a value.
Yeah, exactly. Can we provide anything extra? So I think that's a really helpful point.
Yeah.
All right.
And that's the reason why I think that our one in campuses are not an example. What really happened.
Okay.
Just as a sort of timing note, if you're looking at the schedule, the reason we haven't started a break yet is that they're also running late downstairs and we're trying to align the breaks so that we can mingle with the rest of our community. So if we can sort of wrap this session up in about the next 5 minutes, or now, anytime. But because
we can figure them out ourselves and then be prepared.
There we go, yeah. One thing is that the way that the Fluno Center works is that even though they have food set up here on the second floor.
Not for us.
Not for us. We are to use the food down in front
downstairs.
Of the downstairs in front of the auditorium.
Downstairs food only.
And then we will resume at...
quarter after.
Oh, okay. They're going to, I mean, downstairs they're going to be 11:30.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because their break is going to be 11 or 11:30. So I think we'll just aim for 11:30.
They're actually breaking it down.
So that's live updates. Okay. Yeah. We'll be back.
When everyone starts coming upstairs, come back upstairs.
Yeah.
Probably sometime around
11:25. And we will start with...
not to be precise or anything.
Introductions. I know we've been going for half the morning already, but we'll start with introductions, including the expanded team up here. So thank you for that discussion, and please come back, and we'll be back in half an hour.
So are we okay to leave our stuff there?
Yes, we will figure that out. I haven't figured out who, but...
at least one of us would be guarding.
Oh, right.
Welcome back, everybody. We're going to start at 11:29, I guess, after the break. So our plan, such as it is to do some introductions. I know we've already been talking this morning, but more formally introduce OSG PAP staff and have all of you introduce yourselves, maybe have some of the folks online introduce themselves, and then we have a couple items planned, but are also open to your questions, directions, feedback as we go along.
I think to clarify that, open to means topics and questions, you know, from here and from online take priority over the stuff that we have planned. So everything we have planned is kind of just backup. Other than introductions, I think we want to do that, but we'll see how it goes. We've got, you know, about an hour, so. So we've asked the staff who are up front here, this is obviously not the whole staff, but we try to get folks here who interact with campuses more often than some of the rest of the staff. So you may have interacted with these folks at some point and they've just been a name on a Zoom call or an email or something like that. So we want to give you the chance to actually learn a little bit about the folks here. And I think like everything else in this session, feel free to interrupt. If you have questions for one of us as we're going along, that's fair game. And then we will go around the room and on Zoom for all the other folks attending. But let's get started. So, Jeff, we can put you on the spot.
Okay,
start down there.
All right. Hi, everyone. I'm Jeff Dost. I'm just at UC San Diego, the OSG operations team lead. Probably have interacted with me if you're at campus and you have student hosted CE, or at least someone from the team. And then also common interactions, even if you're running your own CE and you've opened a ticket, you may need help from the factory ops side of things. Pop up.
Hi, my name is Fabio Villalpas, and mostly help our campus and our researchers do integration between OSDF and NRB, and some monitoring out on the OS Club as well.
At what campus are you at?
San Diego. This is
I'm Amber Lim. I'm one of the research facilitators here at CHTC in the Science Pool. My role is really interacting with researchers, users, getting them started, and helping them with issues.
I'm Matt Chalmersy, OSG software team. I'm kind of involved in the software packaging side, getting other sites, you know, helping them set up and hook up to the open science tool.
Where are you located?
Where are you? Oh, I'm right here. But also at UW-Madison.
So I'm Christina Cook, based at UW-Madison, research computing facilitation lead, which means I attend a lot of meetings, I would say, and I work with lots of different kinds of people, researchers, campuses, hopefully instructors in the future, internal meetings, and so on.
I'm Jim Cartwright, also here, I have a long stretch of the Wisconsin folks here, so at Madison. I'm the OSG campus coordinator, so if you are part of a campus and you are interacting with OS Pool, OSDF, maybe OS Store, I have done with that, you're probably going to talk to me at some point or another. I think I've worked with most of you in this room at some point. And I also run our annual sort of mirror training program called the OSG School.
Hi, I'm Jason Patton. I am an integration developer here at the CHTC at UW-Madison. I don't know if any of you contribute, assuming most of you all already are planning to contribute to the OS pool, but if you also happen to contribute to Ingwin or the Jefferson Lab, so projects like BlackScope or PoolX, I help run some of their OSG pools. But also probably maybe more importantly here, I beat a lot of the metrics to folks like Tim and Marone on usage of the OS. So the things look suspect, and we reach out to you. That's we're trying to keep an eye on them.
I want to add to that because really Jason's role is critical here. That when he talks about, you know, we get reports. Yeah, we get an inbox full of reports every morning. I mean, it's like 10, we're getting close to at least 10 on a normal workday. And Jason doesn't just, you know, make sure these reports get sent out, but he's been very active in helping us develop these reports and make changes to them as we have new questions we want to address and so forth. So when I have my slide up about being proactive about monitoring and stuff like that, a great deal of it comes from interacting with Jason and just help them report it.
Hello, everyone. I'm Tad Tannenbaum. I'm at UW-Madison Center for HPC. I am the HD Pounder technical lead. So everything you like about using HD Pounder is courtesy of Marone, and everything that doesn't work is because of me. I also, specifically for this group, I also worked quite a bit on the Seek dashboard.
I'm Tim Tyson. I'm the release manager for HCCSS and OSG. And also I do a lot of the packaging, RPMs and downstream the packages, but I'm fairly involved in, you know, upgrading our CHCC pool and the OS pool and making sure that our software is working properly for them.
Hello, I'm Matt Westfall. I'm also an OSG software team member along with Matt. Similar role, building and packaging software and some support of our production services program at UW and also at UW.
I'm Les Ringe. I'm at the University of Southern California. I am spending some of my time as a research facilitator and some of my time operating the OS pool. If you get a ticket from me, then something's probably broken.
And is about to be fixed.
That's right.
Cool. Before we go to the rest of you, just any quick questions or any first thoughts about
things you'd like to hear more from the staff?
When I write into support at osg.hgc.org, what happens? How do you handle that?
We have a triage rotation. So somebody from one or two people from staff is on duty every week. And their job is to look at the tickets that come in. I mean, ticket. I'm going to say ticket here, but really it's the email that goes into a system that then tracks things. The noun they use is ticket. So somebody's watching those and making sure, and then they read those and try to figure out who best on the team can help with this question or concern. And then we'll assign it to either a team or an individual person. And then that person, if it's a team, I guess then each team has a method of sort of delegating stuff within the team. It's an individual person can pick up and reply. But at some point, you're probably, you know, getting a hold of one of the people at this table or
colleagues. Yes.
Yeah, good question. And all the emails, like, I mean, we use the ticket system because it gives us a more uniform way of making sure that we're not letting things slip through the cracks, basically. And I'm sure many of you work with ticket systems for the same reason.
Yeah.
So that cover the ground you're looking for?
And what if somebody's like out or sick or whatever?
So yeah, it depends. You know, I think especially for tickets that get assigned to teams, for instance, the facilitation teams, and presumably we're careful enough not to help the entire facilitation team take vacation except around the holidays. So there, I think it's a little more clear that there's coverage at all times. If it's something like it's a ticket assigned to me, you know, if I'm going to take a vacation, I've got a long one coming up in September, I'm going to explicitly, you know, try to hand off tickets before I disappear. And we have away messages and stuff like that too. So. Okay. Anything else quick for the staff, and then we'll do the rest of the group. Okay, so we'll just keep going. Yeah.
All right, I'm Harrison Simrall. I'm the Director of Research and Computing, University of Louisville. We are finally at the door, right at the door, ready to knock integration on OS Pool. I mean, on OS Store.
Yeah.
And then OS Pool, or maybe both at the same time. So we're very ahead of schedule on one and kind of behind schedule on the other.
All good.
Right here next.
Kurt Dodds, IT manager at the Institute for Astronomy at the University of Hawaii. Work closely with our team, Sean. Which is a contributor to OS Pool, just stood up within a Kubernetes cluster, you know, contributing. Awesome as well. So,
and you guys are contributors to OS Pool and OSTO.
Very interesting, actually. Not on top of Friday, just before lunch in the end. So, stick around.
Perfect timing, Pascal.
As Kyle Bosco started, our operations support for powerful OSG. Here, very thought that it would be sites on the floor in leveraging the service and see how the team responds just in case there is something for the operations support perspective that we can come to the center of the.
Lincoln Bryan, University of Chicago. I work with Pascal here. I'm the advanced cyber infrastructure manager. So I am the team lead on a team that supports a lot of OSG and Atlas computing networks. Our large tier two center for Atlas, as well as the two of the OS Pool, three of the OS Pool access points. We contribute various resources to the OS Pool.
Does everybody know what Atlas is? Large experiment on the Large Hadron Collider. Okay.
One of the two projects that discovered the Higgs boson.
Oh. Name to name.
Hi, everyone. I'm Rachel. I am a facilitator at Georgia Tech, formerly of CHTC. And yeah, Georgia Tech has four HPC clusters and one Condor cluster that he needs to go with.
Hi.
So I'm Mark Prenz. I'm from Indiana University, the Center for Applied Cybersecurity Research. Yes, I'm a cybersecurity professional. I am the new CISO for OSG, taking over for Mike Stanfield. I'm also the CISO for Trusted CI, which is the NSF Cybersecurity Center of Excellence. I've been in the academic community for about 13 years, starting out on the SWAMP project here at University of Wisconsin-Madison. So I know some of you from that, and the Condor project from that. I just want to say before you run the other way from a security professional, I'm here to try to help enable you to do something you want to do better. I try to take that approach with security. So if there's security controls that you feel are in your way, please let me know. And I'll see if there's like maybe an alternate control that we could possibly use to make things go smoother. But in the next couple of months, I'm likely to just be getting up to speed with everything and kind of doing a survey of assets.
Peter Bismethi, I'm the Associate Director for Research Computing at Syracuse University. A big part of what my team does is manage the infrastructure for research computing, and the other big piece is the liaison between the researcher and that infrastructure, try to align the research for what we think would be the best resource for them to go work.
And I'm Stephen Wheat, Oral Roberts University in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Gave more or less the bio yesterday, but something I'll add to it is that on the one friction free, one Oklahoma friction free network, where we have the 28 institutions, I manage that weekly call where we, every one of those institutions had a science driver part of a CC Star proposal, and we encourage those behind those and they're fulfilling the aspirations they have set forth and monitor that network and facilitate that data transfer. I will tee up three questions. What is the difference between OSG and GLO? What is that for?
Yeah.
And what is a VO?
Okay.
And
lucky somebody's not for you.
What is the difference between batch and payload?
Ooh. Okay.
We'll pass that on.
Perfect.
Hello, I'm Julio Ibarra, research professor at Florida International University. I manage a Center for Technology and Mental Research there. We have an HPC on campus and the OS pool. We also have two CC Star awards, one for compute and one for storage. The one for storage is in the process of integrating or getting connected to Pelican. We've been working with Brian on doing that process. We have some data. We're gathering quite a bit of data from different parts of the university, but mainly from its environmental data that we're mostly interested in getting on the OSDF and working with Pelican.
My name is Mary Jameson. I'm a research and building sysadmin at the University of Montana. I manage a whole bunch of different types of Linux systems on campus, but most recently have started getting involved with our HPC. We have a smaller HPC, about 50 worker nodes, so nothing too big, but we are contributors to OSG, and yeah, trying to figure out how to keep that running.
I'm Ivy Wells. I'm with the University of Montana. I manage Mira and Crusoe, who gave a talk yesterday. I'm the director of enterprise computing, which is University of Montana's way of putting a whole lot of people together into one person. So I oversee sysadmins, IAM, and research.
I'm Lauren Michael, soon to start as associate director for research engagement at Internet 2, doing a lot of the same work I've done with them as an independent consultant, which really pertains to individualized consulting with campuses on cyber infrastructure strategy, pointing them to resources like the OS pool, Condor, et cetera, and beyond. I do a lot of stakeholder engagement at various scales from campuses up through the national level, working with the National Science Foundation. And for a long time, I led research computing facilitation here at UW through CHTC and for OSG.
Wong Wan, George Washington University. Said earlier, we're hoping to integrate today. First time I heard about the OSDF, so my director to give us some money to play.
And then I'm going to ask Amber to kind of work through the folks online just so we have not the chaos of everyone trying to introduce themselves at the same time. If you're willing to introduce yourself out loud.
Okay, yeah, let's start with Amy.
Smoke outside, yeah, not so.
Hey, good afternoon. I heard a bunch of people that I recognize. That's good. My name is Amy Apon. I'm a program officer in the Office of Advanced Cyber Infrastructure for NSF. I'm the lead PD on the CC Star solicitation. I see some of my PIs. It's great. Sorry I'm not there.
Next, let's have Jean Miyahara.
Okay, that's fine.
Let's move on to the next person, Kai
Leong Wong. Hi, this is Kai, Adam. I'm from DW and HPC specialist. I'm working with Fawn, of course.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Next, Mia Robinson.
Hello, everyone. My name is Maya Robinson. I'm a graduate student at Jackson State University, and I'm part of the team where we're trying to implement a Condor system on campus.
Next is Yadir Mara de Silva. Next, let's move to Marcio Antonio Costa.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, my name is Marcio. I am from São Paulo, Brazil. I'm from Sprace, tier 2 for CMS.
Thanks for calling in. Next, let's have Kevin Weiss.
Hi, hello. I am, like Adam, also with the George Washington University. I'm a cyber infrastructure specialist. I've been working some with the team on integrating a small cluster here into the pool. So thank you guys for hosting this. Happy to be here.
Next is Marian Sabata.
Oh, hello. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Hopefully you can see me, and I'm so happy to see so many faces they already know me too, right? So me, Marian Zvara, I used to work for OSG or with people from OSG for almost 10 years until 2021. So I'm still happy I can collaborate with you, even though from a different site. And I live in Utah right now and working full remote for Georgia Tech. So hi to my colleague Rachel over there, who is there in person. And I work in architecture and platform team and helping to deploy and integrate any kind of things that our infrastructure needs. And of course, mostly the one who takes care of the OSG support at Georgia Tech these days.
Next, let's have Ashton Graves.
Hello,
your audio is really soft, Ashton.
Oh, sorry. Maybe I just speak up. Is this any better?
A little bit.
A little bit.
Okay. Yeah, I work at the University of Nebraska Lincoln. I'm a part of PATH. I'm half time PATH. I work on OSG. I'm on Jeff Dope's team, where I work on OCCEs and also on BRAC. The per county. And then I'm also a part of the National Research Platform, NRP, so some of you might recognize me from there.
So if you didn't catch all that, Ashton works on hosted CEs with Jeff as well. Yeah.
Awesome. And then lastly, let's have Michael Tai.
Hello, it's Mike Tai. I'm at Carleton College in Minnesota. Small liberal arts place. We have a small HPC, and we're just getting started with OSG.
Well, thank you everyone for the introductions. This is really nice and interesting mix of folks here, so living here and online. So a good sort of a good demonstration of what this community is, I think.
All right, do we want to do?
So, Yazir said he missed his turn.
Oh, feel free to and introduce yourself.
Okay, thanks. My name is Jadir. I'm working at São Paulo State University in Brazil. I'm a CISADME at Tier 2 BR Sprays, the same place that Marcio works to. And I'm happy to be here today.
Thanks for joining.
Yeah, I would note that we've had a very long collaboration with the folks in São Paulo, so it's nice to see that continuing.
Okay.
Want
to do questions or CE dashboard?
I'll leave it up to you. Do you guys have questions for us, including online, or you've got some tool, or the next kind of thing that we would propose is to have Todd demonstrate the CE dashboard. We've got plenty of time for both. So you guys want to do questions now? I see.
Yeah.
Okay, let's do questions. We'll get to the dashboard. Well, Stephen did ask his already, so let's start with those.
And then we'll put you on deck.
Yeah. Let's see, I wrote these down.
What's a VO?
Yeah, what's a VO? A naughty word. So what does it stand for? Virtual organization. What does it mean? Nobody really knows. But it historically in OSG was used as groupings of people that typically had some sort of common theme that wasn't an institution. So we wouldn't group necessarily people from one institution together, asterisk, because of your other question. But you know, typically it was sort of like a large collaboration research project that would span multiple institutions. So there's the LIGO VO, and so forth. We've really, at Marone's guidance, mostly stopped using the concept and really focused more now on the concept of a pool, which is a lot easier to define. Still not easy, but easier to define. And so now we tend to talk about the OS pool, the LIGO pool, the ICE pool around. That's
But it was our attempt to like not use the word, I don't know, group or institution to define kind of a well-defined stakeholder group that was part of the OSG.
Now, to your question about OSG versus GLOW, GLOW is actually, I'm going to contradict my previous definition. GLOW is the Grid Laboratory of Wisconsin, and it was a VO specifically set up for Wisconsin and then just this institution. So we kind of broke the rules there. And we also did that at UNL with the Holland Computing Center. They also had a VO. HCC and GLOW VOs are, I would say, primarily a thing of the past at this point. Most of the users in those communities, researchers in those communities are part of the OS pool.
So in the reports, it says GLOW, you know, 74.0.
They're coming from, those are researchers coming from Wisconsin.
Okay.
Yeah.
Specifically.
And then.
Which is so obvious from that name.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's got a W in it. So batch versus payload. Yes, if you go to not the CE dashboard, but if you go to our less favored fake news, I'm required to call it fake news accounting system called GROG. You will see the terms batch and payload as sort of types of jobs. The batch jobs are really what we would call the glide-in jobs. So those are the jobs that if you have a Slurm cluster, those are the jobs that you're going to see on running on your cluster. So in other words, they're running on your batch system, hence the name. But that's just the glide-in. And so it's accounting for the time and usage of the whole glide-in, even when it's not running researcher jobs. Okay, so that's one style of accounting. If you look at the C dashboard, really we're calling that the contribution, which I think is a better panel. Payload then is the researcher job. So whenever we're accounting for the researcher jobs that are running within glide-ins, we're putting that into the payload bucket. And now we tend to just call that, I think in the dashboard, it's called the allocation. So you've got contributions versus contributed versus allocated. That is morally equivalent to batch versus payload.
So if everything is working, your batch contributions should always be larger than your payload contributions.
Otherwise, not by much.
Yeah, no, but hopefully they're close together.
Yeah.
So that means that all of the glide-ins are always busy running work. We would have problems if it was the other way around.
I think I've seen it happen at ORU. Anyway,
how things are possible.
I don't even know why, but something. Yeah, good questions.
Yeah.
So if you have a mixed container and glide in, C based.
So the way that I don't feel expert in this, but if you're contributing using containers just alone, there has to be a sort of different mechanism to account for the runtime of the container itself and the capacity that it's providing. Because the way that we get the batch hours for regular glide-in jobs is just technologically different. I think if a site that was running both, they would, in Grok, they would all get lumped together. Just via two very different mechanisms.
So when I see batch, for example, at 400 and payload at 15,000, that makes sense.
So if you're looking on Grok, this is part of why it's fake news. It's all of Grok is based on job completions. So let's think about this for a second. When you're talking about batch, you're talking about recording the contributions at the moment that the glide-in terminates. So if, as is typically the case, you have glide-ins that are running for 3 days at a time, then all of that 3-day contribution for the glide-in itself is counted on the day at the moment it terminates, which is kind of dumb. And there are sites where the glide-ins end up being very synchronized. And so when I'm looking at my reporting, which is Grok-based, unfortunately, in the mornings, what I'll see is a pattern of 1 day of a lot of batch activity, and then zero, zero, a day of a lot of batch activity, zero. They're running smooth all the time. But I only know that because I've been staring at this data.
It explains Stephen's earlier question.
Oh, okay.
You were looking at a plot that was curiously periodic,
yep,
in that way. So
same things are true with in Grok with the payload reporting. It's based on when a job, a researcher job in this case, finishes. So if a researcher job starts today, right now at noon, and happens to run for 15 hours, all of its time and all of its accounting information will be reported for tomorrow, depending on where the day buttons are. Don't quote me on that. So, yeah, and this will be very much in contrast to what the CE dashboard is doing as far as how it gets its data and how it's reporting the data, which is much more sort of continuous and tends to be a lot smoother, which it personally, I think, reflects reality a lot more than what Grok is.
And so my question is, the on Docker Hub, I see that HTTP word is listed as a tech preview. I'm curious if that label still stands, and if so, problem.
We look at the Connor team.
Yeah. Well, I think the question was the Docker containers for HTTP handler with some of the technology.
I think that we need to revise that.
We've had
it
out there for years.
Yeah.
So
we'll take.
I've been looking. It's like, oh, I wonder when this one's gonna be done.
Yeah.
Okay.
But essentially, you know, the containers on Docker are what you'd expect. It's just, you know, I think we use Enterprise Linux 9 for those containers. And,
yeah. Right. Yeah. Yes.
And then yum install agent counter and do that, but then save you the time of doing the Yum install. But But yeah, we can.
So like for these guys, yeah, we submit technology preview because
yeah,
it is the thing.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks. Any other questions?
Online also, either put something in the chat, and we've got a couple folks here watching the chat, or raise your hand, or just unmute if you don't hear any sound and holler. But I did see a couple hands in the room.
Do you have a first Wednesday at print purchase?
Yes.
Yes.
This is tornado siren tester.
Oh, did you? Yeah, yes, heard it.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, now I go straight.
Yeah. Don't be alarmed.
Oh.
At the moment.
Be alarmed. I mean, it's, you are being alarmed, so feel alarmed.
If you don't hear it, that's when you should be alarmed.
Nobody would ever think, you know, like, I don't look at my, anyway, okay. There was another, I thought I saw another hand somewhere.
Anything from online?
Online? Oh,
in a vacuum. What is the minimal contribution of storage for OSTF that would?
What is the minimum contribution? It depends.
It's
complicated. Yeah. No, I think I would say anything in the like more than 100 gigabytes, but that's me personally. That's not sanctioned by the management. I know when we were talking about allocating space in the OS store to projects that want to host their data there, essentially, not store it long term, but stage, cache, whatever. We're like, oh, you know, we're going to start with just like big projects because we don't want to be like managing like, you know, hundreds of little projects to share their data. But I think there's also a space for that kind of sharing, and like for some people, even sharing like 50, 60, 70 gigabytes of data might be meaningful. But I think the more official answer would probably be like hectare, right? Or not. Would be like in the several terabytes, at least hundreds of terabytes. That might be what I'm getting my units confused. That might be what I would say as well. But
so 150 terabytes, for example, would be.
I think that would be. But
yeah, you point out that there's storage and caches, and I'm not really sure what kind of what the guidance is as far as attributing a cache. For instance, we don't have cache in Hawaii. That's a gap.
Oh, we're sure.
Yeah, I mean, and I think there are recommendations somewhere sure. on the website.
So you might think about your Oklahoma consortium and think, well, it should have at least one cache somewhere.
Yeah, and then if you have a chunk of storage and just there's storage, throw a cache service on top, and then it becomes part of the OSDF.
You could use the same storage, actually.
Right, right. Yeah.
Okay.
So different, that's a really good point. That's great.
Are there SLAs associated with storage that is donated?
So we had a leadership meeting last week where there were some questions like this came up. And the conclusion was we don't have anything written down, but we should. So that's on my plate after this week is over. to kind of write up like expectations for people who are providing storage, for people who are using the storage, being able to tell them like, this is how and why you'll access your data. Don't treat this as the only copy. No guarantees. Kind of a thing. So, but I think we can handle downtimes.
Yeah, you're asking from a provider of the backing store kind of thing, plus the origin
right.
service if you're running it versus us. I mean, I would argue the same things apply. We should write some of that down, but even on the, I mean, what do we have for the OS pool? We don't say a whole lot, to be honest. I mean, it's sort of like, you know, if you know you're going to be down or you are down, let us know. I think that's a lot of it right there.
But I think we probably hold people to the same expectations we hold ourselves, which is like everything is running all the time, except when it's not. And then we try to communicate that to the relevant people and get it up again as soon as possible. But it's definitely not like a 5-9s kind of a situation at all. Matt, were you going to add to that?
Well, I was going to mention, though, that I think storage is a little bit different than compute because I'm not going to say all compute is equal, but generally, if one site is down, a job can go somewhere else. But if the origin that is in front of one group's data goes down, they're going to have to wait till it comes back up, like because we start work. Yeah, unless we start replicating the data.
So Tim mentioned OSTF on them. I mean, so and I mentioned the dashboard, but status of the network, I mean, an interesting view to see of any down.
Oh, and we're very much already exploring sort of different views of origins of caches, of effects on OS pool sites and jobs running at those sites. So we're sort of trying to figure out ways to look at all these things. But again, very preliminary.
Generally, the organization is running an origin, right? Like it's their own user community whose data is at that origin. And so they're not necessarily.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's what the OS store is really starting to change, where we are being given chunks of storage on whatever storage system is behind an origin. And then Christina and team are placing other researchers' data there, or staging other researchers' data there, that presumably there's no connection to the underlying institution.
Gotcha. So that's a case where the SLA thinking may importantly differ from contributions of computing for a locally owned origin that only serves local users.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah, because
they
are
sort of all in-house for that.
They're delegating that responsibility to us, and so we have to start taking that seriously. And Matt's point is a great one, that if we stage only a single copy of some research group's data, that places a greater burden of responsibility on us to be responsive if for whatever reason that data is no longer accessible. And we have talked about repetition. That's one strategy.
As one strategy, it's like we could put it in two places. Yeah.
So the University of Montana has about 500 terabytes of storage that we're planning on contributing to the OSTF. And that's spread across three different servers, physical hardware servers. And I guess my question is it easier on the OSDF end of things if we set that up in a parallelized file system in a cluster and provide kind of one chunk of storage to you? Or is it okay to set up agents on like all three and provide three different servers for storage? Like, is there any meaningful difference?
I mean, the only meaningful difference is like, you know, if we wanted to use all of it
right,
for one person.
Yeah.
But if we have three customers who were like, each of them would fit nicely on one of your servers, then it might even be easier that way because there's like a separation between the two. So
yeah, we're kind of, from a technical point of view, we're kind of trying to hide from the user which origin their data is hosted at, right? I think Merlin pointed out yesterday that we should be talking about namespaces, not origins. So whether two different namespaces are co-located at the same origin or are all different. So are behind the same origin or they're behind two different origins to the end user, they really shouldn't notice the difference.
Well, there's no much problem with the same problem. We can see the difference between value and creative namespaces. I think it's technically easy to have just one problem and you can figure out the rest.
Is there a preference for how the storage is presented, S3 versus?
No. Well, Pelican can talk to S3 and POSIX are the two most common. As our fellow shared, they're working on Globus integration this summer, helping out experts. Are there any other backends?
We can absolutely see if we had any of the experts too. I don't know.
POSIX is more, the most common one.
POSIX,
yeah. So a lot of people have like a SEP store and then mount. We just basically mount it into the origin service. But
are there any features that are different for accessing data based off of the backend? Like this.
Well, like Globus right now is read only but not write, for example. So that's a good question.
Yeah, this version of stuff is still able to be done on S3. There's different configurations for each backend.
All right.
Okay, so I think
we're going to turn it over
transition
to Todd.
Learn more about the C dashboards.
All right. So far, five to 10 whirlwind tours.
Yeah, 10. Yeah. That's good. And then, you know, interspersed with questions.
Yeah, sure.
All right. So, yeah, I mean, again, this is meant to be very interactive. This is not a formal presentation. So, folks in the room, just holler if you have a question along the way. And folks online, you'll be able to see. Todd is going to share a screen in a sec. Same thing, either holler really loud or put questions in the chat. I remember you're talking to the owl, so
okay.
I don't
know how to get this fancy bar off my head. You guys see it? Oh, the first play.
Yeah, there's a way to play for some goals. Oh, man.
All right, good enough. Okay. So it looks like it's up there.
I think we should turn off even more lights.
Tim's working on it.
Yeah, I'm working on it.
Let's go, though.
Yeah, okay.
All that's happening, I do have a question.
Yeah.
If you set up a storage contribution and then you deploy a new storage solution and you want to migrate, is that a process you go through?
Wait, I don't think anyone has asked us that question yet. But if you, so you're basically like, I have this storage, I'm going to replace it with this storage. I think we just coordinate with you.
Let's talk.
Yeah. Either be like, we're going to kick out the data that's there, or we'll copy it over. Yeah.
All right, C dashboard.
Yeah. Sorry, is there a link? Like, it's just very small. Is there a link you can tell us?
Yes.
Yes.
Let me put that in the chat over
here. And then maybe the. All right, is everyone here on the OSG Slack? Pop it into one of the campus channels.
Zoom chat.
If anyone else, I mean, I will walk around with my laptop if you need the URL. I mean, just raise your hand or something.
I put it in the chat, the Zoom chat.
Yeah, but most people in here are not.
So if you want the same one that I'm using, then together.
It's Spark, right?
Yeah, using the dev instance.
Oh, well, this is a production one.
The dev. Okay, so we have two versions of the dashboard, a dev one, and after that runs for a week or two, then it moves to the production. So it's just doing that. So the CE dashboard, making it bigger, does that help or not really?
A little bit.
Okay. The CE dashboard, first thing it does is it is getting information from your campus CEs. So if you're not running a CE, there's no information for it to show, right? If you're running containers. The other thing to keep in mind is for your CE to know what's going on your cluster, there has to be network connectivity from the execution nodes in your cluster where the execution points run to your CE. So if there's a firewall, you know, blocking outgoing traffic from your execution nodes to your CE, the CE can't record it. Other things to note before we just kind of get started on the website itself is Tim was talking earlier, but this is what's happening right now, you know, job things that are running right now as opposed to jobs that completed or whatever. So it's taking a snapshot of what's going on right now every couple minutes and storing that over time for you to look at. So this happens to be the one for the CHTC Slurm cluster that's running here, that's contributing resources. First thing is this box right at the top, and this is what's going on as of the last update, which says it was 12:04, so this would be, you know, 10 minutes ago. This box CE health This is your actual CE healthy? Is it overloaded? Is it encountered problems in general? You should see that as good. If you don't, we probably know it as well and are working on it, but if you notice it before us, you can always send in a support ticket. Then it gives the number of projects, fields, and organizations that are using your cluster as of the last update time. So as of 10 minutes ago, there are 14 projects using our cluster. A project is, think of it as a specific research project. A field, 12 fields, that's a field of science, you know, chemistry, biology, nuclear physics, you know, or what have you. And organizations you can think of as a university or campus, you know, Wisconsin, MIT, Montana, right? Who's you know, where is the researcher located that's using it? And then it just says how many CPUs are currently being used by OSP researchers.
That cores?
That is cores. Yep, CPU cores. Moving along. We have some overview charts. This is called the overview page. And here's this first one is CPUs in the past week. I'm just gonna, if you hover on the graph, you get all the usual kind of, you see the data points, you see the hover points. There's also this menu that pops up that has full screen, download data, and edit. I'm just gonna click on full screen right now because maybe that'll help people see. And there's CPUs allocated and CPUs contributed. So CPUs contributed is this line in red. And these are the CPUs that your organization is offering up to the OS pool. And CPUs allocated is the OS pool actually found a research project that matches with those resources and has allocated those resources to a specific project. Okay, so from the questions earlier, you can almost, you know, think of this red as pilot.
Let's not, the don't get all the terms are not good.
Oh yeah, forget about the other terms. So any question on contributed versus allocated? Great. And, you know, a common question might be, well, look, I'm contributing, you know, right now on the order of 1300, CPU cores, and there's only about, you know, 200 or 300 of those are not being allocated to a research project. You know, why is that? Could be a lot of reasons. It depends. I can invoke the Livni law. It could be that there just isn't currently enough work submitted to OS, enough jobs to run. That is almost never the case, because we have a lot of researchers that will, you know, place millions of jobs, and they, you know, the more resources you give them, the happier they are. Usually it's some other resource is being constrained. In this case at Wisconsin, it looks like memory is getting very tight. And so as memory gets more tight, you can see kind of the CPUs allocated goes down. And this is just the fragmentation on the individual servers. If a server runs out of RAM, it might still have a few CPUs free, but those CPUs can't be used except maybe by jobs that use a tiny, you know, 100 megs or something like this. But most of the projects in OS will run at least on the order of maybe a gig per core. So, you know, so it looks like we're a little more memory starved on our resources that we're contributing than CPU. We also show disk allocated and contributed. It looks like at least for our cluster, we have plenty of disk. BCUs is a, you know, experimental idea. Are we going to keep it on the dashboard? I don't know. It's kind of up to you guys. But the idea of a BCU is a basic contribution unit. And what does that mean? It means if we look at all the jobs that are being placed at OS Pool over the past several months, approximately 80% of them can run if you're offering one core, 4 gigs of memory, and 4 gigs of disk. So we try to break up everything that your institution is offering and per, you know, break it into one core, 4 gig, and 4 gig memory and 4 gig disk chunks, and then plot out, allocate it, and contribute it that way as well. That could, you know, explain, for instance, if you're offering up only 1 gig of RAM per core, your 80% of the jobs probably can't run there. So you might end up not using all the resources. Is that something we're going to keep? We're not sure. Moving down, we have we're showing groups served per day, broken up into projects, organizations, and fields. This is just a nice overview over the past week. If the number of projects or something is very low, it could mean that there's some configuration that your site is set up to only prefer certain projects.
Could also mean that project dumped a ton of jobs in the queue and others are less that day. So it can mean a lot of things.
And this one is kind of interesting. Varun likes like this overview. This is a weekly snapshot in bar graph form of CPU hours, memory gigabyte hours, and disk gigabyte hours that are being offered up, being allocated, not contributed, but actually allocated to science projects over the past week. So it looks like we're, you know, kind of averaging 22 to 26,000 CPU cores are being actually used. If we scroll down further, we start answering the question, well, that's great. Who's using them? Okay, I want to know where my cycles are going to. And you can click here, past week, past day, past month. So in the past week, 47 different projects have been allocated CPUs, and here's a breakdown of it. It looks like WSU3D Hydra has used the majority of in the past week at 18%. If I'm curious, in the past day, I could click on past day, and it was still W3SU Hydro. You have a table which shows the exact same information as the pie graph. So at the top contributor is this W3SU Hydro. Its field is nuclear physics. It's coming out of Wayne State University. And over, in this case, I clicked on the past day. So over the past day, it has used an average of 208 CPUs. And throughout the past day, it maxed out at 415 CPUs. If you're curious to know what the world this project is about, you can click on the name in the table, and that opens another tab on your browser, which tells you who the PI is, Jun Shen at Wayne State, and a short little description. Some of the descriptions are, well, I don't know why, failing to fetch some resources. A description of the project: dynamic modeling of relativistic heavy ion nuclear behavior. Does that crystallizes it for me as a nuclear physics expert, not. But that thing, and now I can't click on anything because Zoom is in my way. Sorry. Someday Zoom will go away. Someday Zoom will go away. Someday Zoom will go away. All right, Zoom will never go away. I'll just move my browser down. I know I'm sharing. You don't have to take up 80% of my screen telling me you're sharing. Okay. Like you'd expect, you can click on column headers to sort these any which way you want to. the Rhinosaurium. You can also come up here. This is the overview page. So if I click on overview, this is where I go. I can click on contributed as well to get more details about the resources that I'm contributing to the OS tool. Or it's not just the OS tool. You might be contributing it if your CE is contributing to IGWIG cyber infrastructure or USCMS. I mean, this is just what your CE is doing. It doesn't really matter what pool the resources are going to.
How will that show?
As contributed or in allocated.
So right now, there's no way to see the differences in contributions or break it down or filter or anything like that. That is a feature request from someone at this table to Todd.
Very good.
One more. The three book the traditional.
The overview.
A very tough one. See, in visual, the operators looking at this can possibly be reminded of what kind of shape of pilots you're selling. It's like simple four pilots, eight four, what's the configuration? Because that helps you interpret the load of the resources that you have on the red part. It's a number, but you know, I've been at some point in the past, 2 years before, I said, oh, we want this configuration, but then people forget about it. And then you have to combine it. It's like, why do I look the data that I look? It's, I don't know if it can be dynamically extracted from someplace, so the shape of the pilots, looking at each other, or it can be manually inserted.
Well, to make Todd's life easier, at some point we will be moving those pilot shapes into the configuration, so they'll have that.
Okay, so it could be extracted from the,
yeah, but we're not there then.
You could
probably determine it from the attributes. And
so, yeah. I mean, regardless of how, I think it's a good suggestion. And for exactly the reasons that Pascal pointed out, is that, and I've seen this, I mean, people, I don't remember how different sites are exactly how they're contributing. I have an easy way of looking it up. You guys don't actually have an easy way of looking that up, other than looking at your batch system and trying to see, you know, find, isolate the OSG jobs and look at the shape of the OSG jobs. You can do that. But that's not a very direct way to answer the question. So yeah,
I mean,
that's
the purpose of an overview is to give you a bird's eye view of what's going on.
Yeah.
But it also its purpose is to give you the quick and easy way of figuring out there is a problem, there is no problem. That number will help.
Yeah.
Because it kind of triggers all the questions sometimes. Why do I see the load that I see?
Yeah.
Why do I see this many jobs? What kind of payload should I expect to see if this is the shape of my house?
Yes, and that's well, sparks an interesting example because we have like three or four different shapes sliders that they're all, it's all getting aggregated into one big overview right now, but you can't have something like to see, okay, what's the I memory, what's the GPU, what's the
there's definitely standard. That can go on the detailed level.
Yeah, like another
yeah.
Great idea.
Thanks, Pascal.
So if I So this is the overview page, right? It'll speak this one over. If I click on contributed, I get more details. And this just shows stacked graphs for each resource. So you can kind of compare CPU to memory for the exact amount of time. And another nice thing about this is, you know, you also have the past day, past week. So I can click on past week, and there it goes. I can click on past month. Oh, and I see right from the past month, it looks like CPU's contributed is kind of leveled off at a lower level than it was. And I can see, oh, that happened right around May 12th. Now, when you look at this, you know, it's for CPU, memory. We happen to have contribute GPUs as well, so it shows GPUs, disk, ECUs. Now, what you can also do, oh, the other thing with these graphs is all the usual things. You can draw a little box, and that, like, zooms in on an area, and then you right-click and zoom back out. So This is showing, you know, contributed and allocated. Let's say I want to know who's using my memory, for instance, in the past month. I can click on allocated details. I can do that for CPUs. I can do it for disk. And I get this graph, which is an explosion of the stack graph of the allocated area with a sprite for everyone, every different project that is using memory. Maybe I'll put it at past day so it's not quite as insane.
Oh,
and you can see per project who's using it. So the other thing I can do is down here at the project table, I can see that my number one memory guy is SSGA for CSP and bioinformatics. And on average has been using 1.9 terabytes of memory. I can also, if I want to see more clearly exactly when they were using this memory in the past day, I can click on that project and it'll show the information just for that one project, right? When they were using the memory at exactly what time of day. And you can do all the same stuff for CPU or GPU or disk or what have you.
I'm going to comment here just because this confused me at one point. That is... Where you have memory up there?
Yeah.
That is for all of that person's jobs at that time point. It's not per, it's not an average per job or anything like that. So they can vary simply by how many jobs happen to be running, or of course they could vary by, you know, it's both number of jobs and amount per job that's being requested.
Right. What is your cluster contributing or being, you know, how much memory on your cluster is being used for science, right? And it doesn't break it up into jobs, it just tells you. This much memory is being used by this project.
This is so many details, Todd.
Should I have done?
No. It's like impressive.
Oh, they keep digging in and seeing.
Yeah.
Can you mention per person? Did you mention say for the project?
Because it's for,
yeah, it's for project. Right.
It's for project. But I know some questions are sometimes have been asked by site admins. Somebody's crushing my freaking cluster. How can I find who? The only information that I have is the project. I don't have the user who is
so actually
submitted the job request to the pilot. The pilot went there. Is there any way for these detailed levels to also pass along as part of the whole pipeline the usernames that submitted?
So we generally don't want to show usernames on public facing sites and stuff like that. That's why we sort of stop at the project level. But if you go back to that Commodore Who tool that I mentioned in my talk this morning, I starred them out. I sort of covered them up on the slide, but in fact, it does expose usernames at the moment. So you can get details about individual
research. Cracked exposes usernames.
For privacy reasons.
But cracked exposes usernames.
Yes, if we're going to change that. So
it's also not like visible on the web.
Right. I mean,
for
you, have to,
anybody
be,
to
you have to be an administrator to use Condor Who. You have to be an administrator on the worker node.
Absolutely.
That's a little bit different than posting it on the public web.
So, Condor Who resources do it in Android's problem.
Wow.
Good idea.
Mark could weigh in.
Birthday. both are even better.
So, we'll break for lunch in a minute. The other room is also behind. So,
okay.
Don't worry.
So I'll finish up. One minute
to lunch.
Download data. This downloads a CSV file, which you can then, for any of these graphs, that you can then import into, you know, Excel or whatever you want. Edit. If you click on this, you can customize the graph in any which way you want. And basically, all the data is sent to the browser. There's this syntax you can look at that filters and slices and dices and chunks up the data any which way, and you can edit it if you want. What you can also do, besides editing it, let's say I only care about projects. I don't care about organizations and fields. I can, you know, get rid of organizations and fields, update the graph, and now it's just projects. You know, maybe I want to have one specific project. I don't care. And once the graph is the way you like it, you can copy HTML for this graph to the clipboard. This copied it to the clipboard, and this allows you to embed the graph easily into your computing center's homepage or your science project's homepage, and you can have a nice little graph there. So in 30 seconds or less, here is my ancient CompSci homepage. And I copied it.
That's okay, the 1997.
Yeah.
That may or may not be true.
I am just going to append right here. I'm going to do a paste. And it just pastes in that thing it showed. I'm saving. And now I go over here and do a refresh. And there is my graph in there. So that's
kind of that's static, right?
What's that?
It doesn't refresh.
It will be refreshed.
It will refresh.
Yeah, on the order of like once a half an hour or something.
So let me just make one comment. I think the detail here is impressive, right? But I think one of the things we've flipped now is the sites will now know more about people's workloads than the people know about themselves. Right? Like as a user, you can't come in and find this information. And for example, in memory, I think this is long term something we should think about.
There should be a project dashboard.
Or better tools for users to like throw in a log file or throw in a job ID and get a nice little like, here's what your profile looks like. That was one of our visions for one of the summer fellows, actually. May or may not have.
It's permitted for hosted CDs, but soon it'll be for any CD, as well as if you run to who here. Does anybody here run their own CD or just have a path for if you have us hosted, you already have it.
And this does not include container contributions, which is because they don't have CEs at the moment, so that's a longer process. But we're not, we are thinking about it, it's just farther off. So I think we're ready to break for lunch. Thank you all. If you have further questions, comments,
if you'd like to talk more, I'm very interested in like what people find useful about this. I mean, I think all of us are.
Yeah.
But I'm also interested in like how do you want to tell the story of like your contributions? What are you contributing to? Is there other stuff less quantitative, more qualitative that we can provide, or that how do you show, communicate this is what we're doing with the OS pool or with OSG? I'd love to talk further about that over lunch or different stuff.
So we have lunch now. After lunch, there's no session in here, so please take all your stuff with you. I think it's going to be fair game to find a spot and leave it in the auditorium downstairs. Somebody will be there. There is a session in here later this afternoon, but not contiguous. So yeah, take your stuff with you. And thank you so much, and come talk to us.
The big conference picture is going to be taken during the afternoon break. Just so everybody knows, that's
for other students.
Thank you for showing up in the rigor.
I'm plugging.
I think I would have heard it.
Oh yeah, thank you.